Okay, so before we get started today, you guys have any questions about our final project? Now you had a little bit of time to think about it. Yes?
Was it final project or the next project?
Final project. Yes, sir.
This is something that actually this would be probably a better question for outside class than mine.
Okay, sure. No questions right yet? Okay, so I will then at least point out to you guys, I emailed about this, but want to make sure we all see it. So over in the final contest section, there is an invitation page. Feel free to forward that to people you might want to come to the contest eventually. It's what I send out to everybody effectively. There is a PDF containing extensive rules, much more than detail than we went to in class. That's a big chunk of your customer requirements for this design. So listen to your customer there. Okay. Lays out the grading of the assignments as well, and then the reporting you have due associated with it. Okay. So there's the introduction, presentation slides, and audio link there, as well as over in the lectures. There's also a frequently asked questions page. So if you have some questions that's not clear in the rules, check there as well. If I am getting frequently asked questions, that does get updated over the semester. So the list there, right, the list is there now, or questions that kind of get asked every semester, so I went ahead and populated it with those. But as kind of things come up over the semester, we'll add to that. So that's another place for you to check. The dates of the contest are there, and then for each of the reports and presentation kind of combos you have, there's a separate handout that has a suggested outline, all that kind of thing, like we normally do for the for every one of the reports you guys have done. Just want to make sure you guys all saw that. And then, of course, there's Flickr albums from every semester, so you can see how teams have done it before. This kind of general Mekki 201 pictures library or album also has pictures of some of the components that'll show up. Video of the track spinning. So this general one can be helpful in terms of seeing the size of some of the stuff, getting an idea of track layout from past semesters, that kind of thing. And then there's also some videos from the kind of Georgia Tech version of this class, so you can use that for ideas too. So a lot of information there. I won't point out relevant also to what we're going to talk about today. There's a ton of example code for you. Right? It's I think 44 scripts there, over 3,000 lines of code, I think it is, plus a bunch of extra commenting. That's very well commented code. So it's a lot there for you to draw from. So you're not writing from zero, basically. Okay, and a lot of this will kind of factor into our lectures over the next couple of times. So a lot of this is the code we'll talk about in lecture is exactly there already. Okay, so a lot of resources for you. If you have questions about the rules, if something's not clear, please ask. All right. But do read the rules before you ask, please. Okay, we're both going to get annoyed if you're coming to questions that are clearly answered in the rules. All right. Yes, you're annoying your customer if you're doing that. All right. So avoid doing so, please. Okay. So there was a question about the dissection project, I guess it was. Yeah. Sure. So the question, kind of how much latitude do you have in changing the product in that piece of the assignment, right? Can you increase the cost, that kind of thing? I would say there's a range to that and there's a level to that where it becomes a different customer, I think, right? $100 mechanical toothbrush or electric toothbrush, sorry, I think has a different customer than a $6 electric toothbrush. So I think as long as your changes in design are trying to address the same set of customer needs as the Oral-B, right? If it goes from $6 to $8, you probably are still the customer, right? If it goes from $6 to $60 or $6 to $600, that's a different type of customer, a different product, effectively. Other questions about mechanical dissection? Okay. So I'm going to ask all you guys, laptops away, phones away. Okay. And I ask that today. I usually don't care if you don't pay attention. I'll make fun of you a little bit. My feelings will be hurt, but I don't care. But I think today has such a large impact over the next 4 weeks, or next probably the rest of the semester, effectively. If we don't get the concepts that we talk about today, the rest of this class, particularly the programming section, and your final design are really going to suffer. Okay, so I think the harder you can work to understand what we're talking about today, ask questions today, really pay attention today, everything after this is going to be much easier if you get what we're talking about today. Okay, so try to pay attention. Please keep laptops away today. We'll have plenty of time over the next couple, starting a week from today. Feel free to bring them. Bring your kits a week from today, or Tuesday, sorry. Feel free to bring a laptop. Bring your kits on Tuesday. We'll actually be live coding in class, right? But today, please keep them away and try to pay attention. Ask questions. All right. Okay, so here we go. The language we're going to write in is called MicroPython. It's a subset and a special version of this language called Python, which we'll talk about. Pretty much everything we talk about today is also valid in normal Python. Right? The micro comes in that it was kind of optimized to run on low-powered microcontroller small hardware rather than a full computer. Okay? The core of the kit that you guys bought is this board. It's called a Pi board. Right? Pi for Python. Has some onboard hardware that we're going to use starting on Tuesday. There are actually four kind of onboard LEDs that we can control from the code on the guide. Right? There's a reset button. Right? There's a user button. There's actually an accelerometer on board. Right? So you can measure the acceleration of this board. You also can use an accelerometer to measure tilt. So that can be useful in your device. Right? And measure angle. Right? The processor that's running this guy is a STM32 processor. It's actually an ARM processor, an ARM family of processors. You got a smartphone in your pocket, it's got an ARM chip in it, almost without fail. Okay. So this is not as high-end as what will be in your phone, but it's the same family of processors. Just slower, less memory, basically. Okay. So this is the core, right? And because it's slower and has less memory, that's why we get to the MicroPython instead of Python. Okay. There's also a micro SD slot. So the controller itself has some onboard flash. If you have a micro SD card, you actually can write code to the micro SD card and run it from that instead of the onboard flash. So that's an option that we'll kind of discuss moving forward. Up until last semester, we were using an Arduino in this class. Who's heard of Arduino? Probably more people than MicroPython, right? So Arduino is popular. There's a lot of resources out there for Arduino stuff. There's a few reasons we switched away from it. One is this. So if you look at kind of program language popularity over time, you think about Arduino as effectively kind of a subset of C++. Very similar. You can actually write pure C++ for an Arduino if you want. And you see that curve kind of flat, right? Python is really taking off in terms of the popularity of the language and where it's being used. Okay. So I feel by switching to the Python, and there's, you know, this is one reason, you're going to be better prepared for the type of job you want if you're going to do any programming. Okay. So that's one reason, right? Python gets used a lot. Python is also what I would call a general purpose language. Right? Arduino is a simplified version of C or C++ designed to run on those little microcontrollers and for teaching. Right? That was the customer requirements of Arduino as a language. Right? That's easy for hobbyists, easier for students to get hold of. Right? Python, I think, is still easy. It actually started as a teaching language as well. Right? It's kind of grown into a general purpose language. See, companies like Instagram and Google use it extensively. The entire server infrastructure for the first versions of Instagram were all written in Python. Okay? Google uses it a ton. The kind of machine learning AI community, big data people, use Python a ton. Okay? There's also a ton of robotics tools built around it. So my lab uses this framework called ROS pretty extensively that you can write in Python to talk to this framework ROS. Okay? There's also some other kind of academic reasons, if you're interested, in why I use it in my lab as well. This kind of explains some of those. Right? So why Python instead of MATLAB, for example? Right? And so I use, when you take me for vibrations or controls, we're going to do Python, not MATLAB. Well, one, Python's open source, free. Right, so you guys don't have to worry about buying or stealing MATLAB licenses. Right, so we can use it. It's free, open source, has a nice community around it. The other piece around this is not just the language. I actually think it's an easier language to learn, even though Arduino is kind of designed for beginners, supposedly. But also the Pi board, a kind of dollar per unit power, if you will, processing power, is a much better board than an equivalently priced Arduino board. Right, you have a production scale. That ARM processor is one that's used extensively, high-powered, really nice. Hardware is quite a bit better. I would say it's a more professional board and system than an Arduino is. All right. The other piece also is that, you know, over the last couple of years, we've been using MicroPython in my lab for a while. There's also a whole other family, we can talk about that somewhat later, of boards beyond the Pi board that can run MicroPython. So we'll talk about that too. So, system setup. Hopefully you've done some of this already. I've suggested it in the email, but we'll walk through it again. You're going to need a plain text editor. That means it's not Word. It doesn't do any kind of formatting. It saves just plain text files. Okay. There are many options for that, and programmers get in big fights about this, like which tool is the best and which editor is the best and that kind of thing. Right. The one I think that's probably best for this class is called Atom. Right? It's, again, a free open source project. Right? So go out and get Atom. It's available Windows, Mac, Linux. Right? It's free, open source. Grab it. All right? The other thing you should do in kind of setting up, getting ready for the next few weeks and the rest of the semester is bookmark your documentation. Okay, so here are the links. I sent these out as well. The kind of full Pi board documentation for the bundled into the MicroPython language. Right, so it has the Pi board specific functions, and there's a quick reference page as well. Okay, and do bookmark those because there's going to be syntax and functions and things you're not going to remember. Just look it up. Right, that's why this stuff is there, and that's how professional programmers work too. Right. They don't remember every syntax, order of every variable needs to be. They're going to be working. That's why you see quite often three or four monitors, their main code on one, documentation on another. Right? That's how I suggest that my research students work. That's how I write code. Right? Documentation in one window, I'm writing stuff in the other. So you're not going to remember every syntax. Hopefully you get to a point, you know, the core syntax, but kind of obscure functions, you don't use that regularly, just look it up. Right, there's no need to guess at what it is, in other words. Okay. So, look it up, and you're going to ask me questions. I guarantee people, you guys are going to ask me questions that I don't know the syntax for either, off the top of my head. So, please try not to be frustrated when I tell you to just go look it up, because that means I don't know it either. All right? No shame in that. To connect to your Pi board, there's a micro USB connection on that Pi board. All you have to do is plug in one into your micro USB cable into the board, the other into your computer. Right? When you do that, it should mount as a flash drive, just like a USB thumb drive thing would do. Okay? And it should have these four files on it, kind of from the factory. Right? It's going to have one called boot.py, it's going to have one called main.py. The py is the extension, kind of common extension for these Python files, right? They are just plain text, though. You could open that up with any plain text editor. It's just a text file. No formatting, anything special in there. There's a README text file that explains kind of what's going on in this thing. And then if you have a Windows machine, it's really the only reason you need to worry about the last one. That's the driver if you happen to need it on Windows. Okay? When that board starts up, it runs boot. When it boots, as soon as it's done running that boot file, it starts running main, unless you've told it to do something different. Okay? What you should do, before we do anything else, right? When you plug your board in for the first time, take those four files and drag them from that flash drive into a folder on your computer somewhere. The default, straight from the factory files. That way, something goes wrong, things are acting crazy, you can get right back to the default factory state by just dragging those back over to the flash drive. Okay, so save your copy, back that up, the default from the factory configuration of those files. All right? The other thing I'm going to suggest, right? It looks just like a flash drive, because we're going to be tempted to just double-click on those files in that flash drive and edit them right there. Right? Don't do that. Okay? So don't open that file directly in your plain text editor, the main or boot from the flash drive. Okay? What you want to do is have a local copy of either one of those where we're going to write our code. Right? Once you're finished writing, then take that file from your computer and then drag it over to the flash drive. Okay? Right? And then if you're not in the habit of ejecting or unmounting flash drives from your machine, make sure you do so for the Pi board. Okay? And we need to take these precautions because the flash memory on that board and the processor can get corrupted a lot more easily than a standard thumb drive can. Okay? So we're going to take these precautions, right? Don't edit the file directly on the flash drive. Right? Write it locally, name it, save it on your computer, main.py, then drag it over there. So for example, this is my folder of MicroPython files, right? All kinds of different scripts doing different things. And if we look in any one of these, there's a boot, a main, and actually these have drawings too. So what I would do if I want to edit this main and change that, I would change it on my computer. When I plug in the Pi board, then I just drag that onto that flash drive. Okay. You guys got that? Okay. If you follow that procedure, that's going to avoid a lot of problems. Right? Because if you corrupt that memory, you have to go and reflash that processor, which is kind of a pain to do. Okay. It's not a big deal to do, but it's going to be a pain, particularly if you're kind of last minute trying to make things work. Okay. Okay. And I'll go through this quickly. I mentioned in the email, for some version of Windows, you might need to install a driver. Right. Instructions of that are here, and we're linked in the email that I sent you guys as well. Okay. We're going to work extensively in this thing called the REPL. REPL stands for Read, Evaluate, Print, Loop. And basically what it gives you is a way to run your code line by line and get the response, get the process going. Right? So you don't have to write an entire script and then test it all together. Right? We can do that. But we also are able to interact with the process as it's running, step by step. Right? So to get to that REPL, that's just going to happen over that USB cable as well. So, like the text editor, there are a lot of options for the software you're going to need to be able to bring up that REPL. Right? On the Mac, there's kind of a list. Windows, some other options. A little on Windows, you'll see a lot of the tutorials for the Pi board mention PuTTY. It's fine if you want to use PuTTY. What I'm going to kind of officially support, because we have it on both platforms, is CoolTerm. My screenshots will be from CoolTerm. What I'll show kind of here, what's settings and things like that, will be set up for CoolTerm. Right. If you have the skills and want to use PuTTY, go for it. But just know that kind of our official support is going to be CoolTerm. Okay, so that these links are here. They were also included in the email I sent you guys. Okay. And that's the one website that looks a little shady, but it's fine. All right. Okay. I mentioned the code. There's tons of code available. Hopefully you know about this link already, right? So to get every piece of code in this folder, I showed you guys this on the first day. There's a button over there on the right-hand side. You can download a zip of the whole thing and get every line of code that I just mentioned that's available to you, all 3,000 lines in one shot. All right. So there's tons of stuff there. The template for the class reports is there too, actually. Okay. That's that. Okay. Questions about that part so far? That's kind of the core kind of setup of everything so far. Let me know. Yeah. Yeah, I think, so mention the email. You want to make sure that things are set up when you walk in class on Tuesday, if you're bringing your laptop and working along on Tuesday. Okay. I'm not going to have time during class on Tuesday to help you debug installations and things like that, so try to get in touch before then. But yeah, I can help for sure. And do what I can to help. I'm not promising I can fix everything, of course, but yeah. Other questions? Okay. Where should you be writing the code? On your machine, right. If you write it on your machine, then drag it over to that flash drive. Don't edit directly on that drive. Okay. Make sure you eject it before you unplug that USB cable. Memory there can get corrupted. It's not going to every time, but it can. Happened to, some folks a lot last term. But it can happen, particularly if you're yanking it out without saving, without ejecting. Okay. So let's get to the actual language. What is that? I'm going to start with a piece of the language that doesn't even get run. I think it's that important. And that's comments in the code, right? These comments are completely ignored by the Python or MicroPython interpreter in this case. Okay? And really, they allow you to explain your code right in line with it to your coworkers or teammates or whatever, right? But they also, perhaps more importantly, will explain it to you in the future when you're looking back on a piece of code trying to figure out why you're doing what you're doing. Okay? Work on a project, even in this class, you're going to write some code on Tuesday and get 3 or 4 weeks from now, and if you haven't really commented that and explained how it works and why you're doing what you're doing, you're not going to remember it. So you're just going to have to repeat that whole process of learning that over again. So do your future self a favor and leave some hints about why you're doing what you're doing, that kind of thing. All right. In Python, there's kind of two ways to comment primarily. Right? I'm going to comment a single line of code. I'm going to put a hashtag or a pound sign if you're old school before your comment, whatever you want the comment to be. You can create a block comment by doing 3 quotation marks to start it and then 3 quotation marks to end it. Okay? And I'll show the difference between those right now. Okay? So that top part, you see I open it. It's open with 3 quotation marks, double quotation marks. And everything from those quotation marks till it sees another set of 3 quotation marks is considered a comment. Spanning across multiple lines doesn't really matter. Okay? So look, sees the first 3, and everything until it sees another 3, it's going to consider that a comment. Right? So that's a whole block, that's called a block comment. Okay? You can comment on a single line, again, on a hashtag comment. Right? You can also put these comments kind of after some piece of code, right? So they don't have to be on a line by themselves, right? And we'll do this quite a bit, actually. So we'll do something here, and then have a comment explaining what it is or why we're doing it. Okay. Those block comments are actually a good way to begin every file you're writing, right? So if you look at the code that I've given you guys, right. It has pretty much all those files at the beginning have a block comment that basically include the file name, right? What's the purpose of this particular piece of code? Like what does it do? Right? Should include any kind of external requirements. What piece of hardware do you need for this thing to actually run? Right? Are there other libraries you might need for this script to run by itself? Okay. Maybe explain what inputs are needed, if there's actually the code, piece of code expects inputs, what the output of that code is, what the result of it should be, right? And then you can include at the bottom, kind of like you do on your spec sheet, for example, like a version number, list recent major modifications, right? So you can look at that code right away and know if you've been doing a good job of that, when the last modification was. So that could be, yeah, so that could be kind of an outline of the, so a lot of the code I have will have a table, like LED, you know, sensor pin 1 goes to pi board pin X2 or things like that. Yeah.
Okay, so basically location.
Yeah, that's helpful. Or what you can do is have a link, like you'll see the scripts I have will also have, often have a link to a schematic file somewhere else.
Okay.
Right. So if you do all that in a block comment, it looks something like that. Right, so file name, some description of functionality. If I'm using some non-standard library or something, I'll often include the link to that library's documentation. So if I come back later and trying to figure out what's going on, I can just go right there without having to dig it up. Right? I'll include a created date, right? And then kind of major modification days, right, with contact info. So you can do it with a block comment. I think most of the ones probably in your library just have line comment, a series of line comments. But same idea. Basically, the beginning of the file, explain what the file is about. Right? That's going to save you a lot of time in the future. You have a bunch of Python files now, which one's doing which. You should have nice names. But if you don't, you can look right at the header and understand what's happening in that code, which one's which. Okay. Questions about comments? Okay. One other suggestion, if you're writing code of any complexity, quite often what I like to do, and what I recommend to my research students, is actually write the comments first. Right? Write in comments what the algorithm should be, what you think the order of operations needs to be, and then go back and fill in the actual proper syntax and code underneath those comments. Right? I think it's very similar to writing an out or doing an outline for a report you're writing. Right? Write the outline, and then go back and fill in the actual text. So you can do a similar thing with comments for code. I do this quite often. Right. Write all the comments, understand the structure of how I want to run things, then go back and actually fill in the code. Use these things. Right. They're not only going to help you, they're going to help your teammates, they're going to help the future you, and probably in the context of this class, they're going to help us help you debug your code. If there are comments there, things are named properly, that kind of thing. Okay, variables in Python. Right. So unlike the Arduino language, this is one reason I think Python is an easier language to learn for newcomers or other kind of C-based language. We don't have to specify the variable type. And what I mean by that is you don't really have to tell the system how much memory to set aside for a particular variable. Right. The system handles that for you. Okay. It's called a dynamically typed language. Right. So Python will figure out whether you mean it to be an integer or a kind of decimal number, which has a special name we'll call, or it's actually a sentence like some text. Python can figure that out for you. In Arduino and C-based languages, you have to tell the program what kind of data you're giving it. Right. So it can figure out what you need. And also, you can reassign the same variable to a different type of number, if necessary. Okay. So declaring variables, setting up variables in Python is really easy as a result. You do still have types. You just don't have to tell the program or include in your program what type they are. Right? So you have Booleans are just true or false. Right? So they can be true or false. True or false in Python does have a capital leading letter. Okay, so capitalization does matter here in Python. Okay, so any kind of variable can be a Boolean just by assigning it to true or false. Okay, you have integer variable types, or well, integers, right? So you might have an integer variable as -1. And if Python sees a number with no decimal point, it's going to think it's an integer. Right? It doesn't have any floating pieces, at least initially. Right? So you might have, in the context of this class, motor speed is 75. Or 75 might be the percent motor speed or something. Okay. If you have a decimal place, those kind of variables are called floats. Right? So if you want a float to be 1, you need to include the 0.0. So let Python know that I care about the decimal places on this number. Okay. And you can have more, give you more precision. Right? The only big advantage of the Pi board and ARM processor over Arduino is it can do floating point math. Right? Which is quite nice. Those are the kind of the core ones. The other major one you're going to use in context of this class, for the most part, is a string. So strings, some text you want to store in Python, just comes between quotes. And you actually can use either single or double quotes. So go either way. I think stick with one version. Okay. Questions about those variable types? Yes. No character, yeah. There's no character. Yes?
You said strings were just like for little comments.
So a string is meant to be some words, basically. Right? So we'll see one of the primary ways we use strings is actually to print out information to the user. It's a major use of a string. So I could create a string that has some error message or something that gets printed out to your computer when things go wrong. Right, and that would be a string. Floats, can you?
Explain floats.
Okay, so floats, just think of floats and numbers that have a decimal point.
Okay.
Yep.
And the integers are just without.
Without. Okay. And so if you take and divide, if you divided, another kind of nice thing about this dynamic typing, if I have, so I divided integer variable by motor speed, right? The result, it does automatically for you convert those two to floats due to the division and give you a float back. Right? If this was just an integer, like a C-based language, if you did that, you'd get 0. Because it would round down to the nearest integer. Yes?
How does the program know what you mean by motor speed?
It doesn't yet. I've named it motor speed. So all we've done here, in any of these assignments, all we've done here is say, in this variable named motor speed, store the number 75. Right. In the variable named precise motor speed, store 75.275. Okay. We can also assign multiple variables at the same time. It's kind of a nice feature of Python. Right. So you want to be careful and only kind of group variables that make sense logically. So if you had three different weightings like a house of quality, you could define them like this, right? Where small is 1, medium is 3, large is 9. So you have that option. It can make that a little bit easier to read. They're related. They're all grouped together. It can be the same thing, right? You don't have to do it this way. Those three variables could be defined one line right after the other and be fine. You could do things like this. Like, so the Python networking library needs an IP address as a string, and then the port number for the networking stuff, if you're going to do networking. So those things kind of naturally belong together, so you can group them online. Okay. I'm going to suggest, and you probably have seen a little bit already, that you adopt some variable naming conventions. Right? These are not enforced by Python, but they're going to make your code easier to read for you primarily, but also your team, and then help you debug it. Okay. So I think the first thing, and kind of I think part of the question, what do you mean by motor speed, is actually you have the option to give your variables meaningful names. Okay. So something like arm length is much clearer than L equals 15. Right? Arm length as the variable name conveys the information that this is what I'm actually what's stored here, right? L doesn't really give me as much information. So it's a few extra letters of typing, but it makes the code way more readable, much easier to debug for you, right? Or maybe I have delay time or something is 0.25 seconds, right? That's much clearer than just T. I don't know what T is here. Okay. So I'm going to suggest you use descriptive names for your variables. Don't call everything X and Y and Z. That doesn't tell your reader, doesn't tell you, when you're trying to debug, what any of those variables really mean. What are they actually holding? What's the information that they're holding? Right. So in the earlier slide, by naming my variable motor speed, what I was telling myself is that in this variable, I'm going to use it, whatever's contained here, to define my motor speed. Right. I would also strongly recommend you kind of pick a variable style. Right. So the variable arm length above is called camel case. Right. So you separate, kind of define each word by putting a capital letters in the middle ones. Right. So it's got a hump in it, so camel case. All right. I think most of the example code I provide uses this format for its variables. Okay. But you're just as easy, I think you can use underscore for spaces between words if you have multi-word names as well. Okay. Like we did for delay time. I think try to pick one of those ways as your style and stick to it. And if you went to write code and were working in a company where you were writing any significant amount of code, the company probably will have a style guide. And they will tell you, we use camel case or we use underscores. And you have to match the company code, company style. Okay. Also, it's pretty common, particularly across many languages, if you have some variable that you know is not changing, you can write its name in all capital letters. Right? And if you do that consistently, then you can look at that and know that, hey, that thing shouldn't be changing within your algorithm. Okay. Again, that's not just writing capitals doesn't enforce that in Python, but it helps you write your code. Right? So this is largely about making your job easier. Right? These things don't really matter so much for the Python interpreter itself, but it will matter to you and your team, I think. Or does matter to you and your team. Questions about that? I think just pick a style. This is another one where computer science guys, well, programmers and maybe computer science guys will argue about this for days. Which way is better and prettier and that kind of thing. Whatever. Okay. Another important thing about variables is called variable scope. Okay. Variable scope is basically what functions, what pieces of your code are able to read or write from a particular variable. Okay. So in Python, if a variable is defined outside of all the functions in your code, right, then it can be read, it has global scope, we say, which means it can be read from anywhere. In Python, you do need a little bit of special syntax to write to that variable now. Okay, so in Python, you can read global variables all you want. You do need a little bit of special stuff to actually write to them. And we'll get to what that might be later. Okay. If a variable is defined inside a function, I know we haven't really said what functions are yet, but if a variable is defined inside a function, it's only available inside that function. The kind of key point to this is it's good practice, and you want to limit the scope of your variables to as small as possible. Right? So if you only need some variable inside the function when it's running, define it inside that function. And that way, nowhere else in your code can mess with that variable and change what's happening in your code. So you want to limit the scope as small as possible. Python functions then. Okay. The function definition for Python looks something like this. Okay. And you have to match this syntax exactly. Okay. You need the def out front. But def is a key word in Python that says, hey, what I'm getting ready to tell you about is a function. Okay. Define. Short for define. Okay. You get to pick the function name, right? So that part kind of changes. Right, but you do have to give the name next, immediately following def. Right? Like variables, give your functions reasonable names. Right? Say what the function is doing in the name. Okay? Then you also have to define in that kind of declaration, the function definition, what kind of inputs should it take? How many inputs? What are they? Okay. In this case, we have two input variables. We're going to call them x and y. Okay. And you do have to end this first line with that colon. So this is how I define a function. Then, the next line, we can do something with those two input variables. So in this case, as the name of the function kind of says, we're going to multiply those two inputs together. Then we're going to store them in a new variable called result. Okay. And then we're going to return that back to whoever called the function. That variable. That's called kind of a return definition. Right? Another point about Python. We need to, that first line has to have that kind of exact kind of formatting, a style. The name, the number of input variables will change, but you need def, you do need a name, and you do need that colon at the end all the time for functions. Okay. In Python, white space matters. Right? So unlike Arduino, where you have curly brackets all over the place, or C-based languages, white space matters, so you have to tab or space consistently over in Python. So everything that's tabbed over the same amount underneath def belongs with that function. Okay. As soon as you went back over here, it's not part of that function any longer. Okay. So it's the indentation that tells the Python interpreter what belongs to that function. Excuse me. And of course, all these things have more formal computer science names. But I'm kind of giving you the high-level overview. Questions about function definitions? We'll talk about how to use them in just a second.
When you define that definition, you have to define all the definitions that you're going to be using in that lines, and then using those definitions, going all the way to the justified portion.
So, okay. So I think you're asking questions purely about indentation,
yeah.
Right? So if I wanted to define another function, I would come down underneath here, probably a white space, and then def again lined up with the left, all the way left again. And then for that function, whatever's inside it is part of that function.
Okay.
Yes? Vertical white space doesn't, except for readability. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, let's see how to use that function. Okay. So you can kind of see the spacing here. So we're going to start out at the beginning of this script, defining that function just like we did in the previous slide. Okay. You'll see I come back over to the left side. I'm going to assign values to A and B. A is 2, B is 3. What kind of variables are those right now? Integers. Yep. Okay. So then, I want to take those two variables and use my multiply function on them. Right? Multiplication is built in, obviously, but here's an example, right? Just how to use a simple function. So to call the function, right, it returns something to me. I want to store the result, so I'm going to define a new variable C. Right? These should have better names. Okay. I'm going to call the function by its name, right? And then give it the numbers that I want to pass in as x and y. Okay. So if I do this with our current definitions of a and b, a gets saved as x when it gets to the function, b gets saved as y when it gets up to the function. When it's happening inside the function, operating on x and y, and you return the result, which in this case is 6, obviously. Right? Then 6 is stored in C now. Okay. You guys got that? What's nice about One thing that's pretty nice about Python, I think, is that that works just as well if we have other variable types as well, right? So if A was 1.2 and B is 3.75, I can still call that same function. Right? So I do the same thing, and we get the multiplication of those two numbers back now. Yes?
So instead of going A equals 2, yeah. B equals 3, yeah.
You can just do it. You can. I'm doing it largely here to save space because I ran out of space on the slide and keep it big enough. Again, I think you'd want to group, if you're doing this kind of definition, make sure these have some kind of logical connection between them. Motor speed, motor direction, sensor reading, converted sensor, filtered sensor reading, something like that.
When you get equal, it actually matches
the... Yeah, it'll match the first to the first, second to the second. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. You could, in this case, it's probably better to do that way, but like I said, I ran out of... Yeah, you could do it this way if you're trying to eliminate lines.
Yeah.
But I think that should be way down your list of considerations,
just,
basically.
Just
yeah. No, that's fine. Yes?
Can the function be
So the question was, can the function be anywhere in the code? It has to be defined before you use it. Okay. So this script, the way Python runs, is kind of linearly once it gets in a script. Right. So if I'm going to use the function here, it has to have been defined before that point. Other questions? Yes?
So I can pass anything I want to, but if I pass something inappropriate like a string to that function, it'll get an error when it gets to.
Yes. All right, so the question is, I was just getting ready to ask that. If B was a string that said hello, and I tried to send it to multiply, right? 1.2 times hello doesn't make any sense, really. Right, so the multiplication is going to give you. You're going to get something weird happening, basically. Right. So that's where the kind of dynamic typing can be bad for you if you aren't careful about what you're passing around. Right. But you would get an error. You'd get weird stuff, actually. So while Python, you don't have to explicitly tell it what variables are, you do need to at least have some awareness of what's happening. Yeah. Yes. So the question was, can it multiply a float by an integer? Yes. Python will do that type conversion for you. Other questions? Yes.
So the asterisk, Python already knows that it needs to multiply.
Yeah, it knows multiply, so we don't need this function ever. Right? We have multiplication built in, but it's just a simple enough, it is a valid function to write it this way. Just to show kind of how you would define a function to do something. Yeah. Okay. So we want to use functions, right? There's advantages to using functions. Basically, you want to aim for every function you write to have a single function. It does a single thing, right? You have a function that does 15 different things and operates and does different motors and whatever, right? It's going to be really hard to reuse that function anywhere else, right? So having a function that does a single function really makes it more easily kind of reusable. If I have a function that just reads the sensor when it's plugged into a certain port, I could take that read the sensor piece of code function and drop it in any kind of script I want that would read, I want it to read that sensor, right? So it makes it really way more reusable, okay? So that reuse also limits the likelihood of typos and other bugs. You have to write the code once, make sure it's working once, and then you copy and paste everywhere, and you can be relatively sure that as long as you copy and paste it correctly, it's going to be working wherever you paste it, right? Rather than having to retype everything every time. Okay. It also makes your code more readable. We'll see an example of that in the next slide. Okay. By having functions. By making program logic easier to follow. Generally, we'll make the execution more predictable as well as a result of the things above. So for example, the kind of core part of your final project code might look something like this, right? Wait for the start button. So as soon as it's sitting there waiting for the start button is pressed, that function returns, waits a little while, and then you might have functions that are drive forward and take some variable that's 4, that means 4 seconds, right? So these would all be functions you've written for your device, right? Inside drive forward can be a whole bunch of code that actually handles the actual low-level part of driving forward. But the algorithm of how your robot is working is immediately evident here. Whereas if you had the big block of code for drive forward and then the big block of code for rotate arm, it's less clear about what the actual robot is doing, the algorithm that it's operating under. Okay. So inside the main code is this, and then you have functions defined that, that do each one of these things for you. Okay. Other questions about functions? Okay. So we've mentioned debugging a few times. This is going to be a big part of your job anytime you're writing code at all, is fixing all the bugs in it. Okay. I think the key thing to remember if you're debugging code, whether it's on this board or anything else, you get to 301, write some MATLAB code, you come to my vibrations class or controls class, we write a little bit of code, right? You're doing research and writing code. One of the key things to remember is that the computer or the processor is only going to do exactly what you tell it. Nothing more, nothing less. Right? It doesn't make any assumptions about things. Right? It does exactly what you tell it. Right? So you have to make sure you're telling it what you really want it to do. Right? Computer's pretty dumb. Right? Nothing more, nothing less. Exactly what you tell it to do, that's what it's going to do. All right? So when you're debugging, right? Walk through your code line by line. What exactly am I asking this program to do in this line? Right? We also can take and output the values in runtime through the REPL thing we just talked about a little while ago. Right? So we can have statements in our code that will print things out to our computer and use that to help us figure out where things are going wrong in our code if there are bugs. But I think the first point here is the key one. Right? If you can remember that, you're going to do okay at debugging and writing code in general, because debugging is a big part of it. Right? Computer's only going to do exactly what you tell it. Nothing more, nothing less. So let's talk about the REPL for a second. If you have cool term, it will look something like that. In this case, I'm already connected to the board. We connect to the board, it's telling you what version of MicroPython. Your boards are probably all up to 1.92 or something like that. We'll see when they when we start booting them up. But you'll get a prompt that looks like these three guys. Right? And if you get to that, you can just start writing Python code and it'll run right away. Every time you hit enter, it's going to run whatever you just typed. Okay? So that's our communication. That's kind of our way to develop effectively and get information about what's happening in our code. Okay, so we can use it for kind of prototyping, understanding core kind of functionality, use it for debugging and execution monitoring. Right. So to do that, like I mentioned, we're going to have these print statements. Right. In Python, it's just print, and there's some parentheses, and then whatever string or thing you want to print after that. All right. So I define a function here. Doesn't really need to be a function, but it is. Right. So anytime I call the function print some stuff, it's going to print hello Dr. Vaughn. Right? It's going to print that out to the REPL, right, over that USB cable. Okay? So we can do other fancier things. Don't worry about this line in particular. But I can generate a random number and then just print that number out. Right? And that would print out a random number to the REPL. Okay? And if I call the print some stuff function, then it would print hello Dr. Vaughn. We can make this print stuff a little bit fancier if we want, which is usually pretty helpful. So in the previous slide, we were printing that random number, but we had no information about what it, that was. We might be printing out a bunch of other numbers in our code. Right? So you can follow this kind of formatting, where so you have some kind of string description of what's happening. There'll be this kind of formatting spec we'll talk about in the next slide. Dot format, whatever variable you want to format, and then parentheses. Right? So follow this syntax exactly. So you can do things like this. If I have an integer that's 42, right, I can do print integer. The formatting for an integer is colon D. The simplest way to format an integer for printing. Okay. So now I know that when that 42 prints out to my screen, it's not just a number among 100 lines of different numbers. I know that it's integer, whatever that happens to mean for my code. Okay. I also can always include a plus or minus sign. Right. So the first one, if it's negative, it'll have a negative sign. If it's positive, it has nothing. Right. So you can always include plus or minus just by putting a plus sign there. You can always make it the same width on your screen if you want, which can be helpful if you have a bunch of numbers flying by to see how they line up, see differences as they roll by. Right? So if you put a number in front of the D, right, this is always going to be at least 4 digits for that integer. Okay? You can also do at least 4 digits and put zeros in front. Right? So this guy would have 2 blank spaces and then 42. This guy would have 0042. When it prints out. So again, this is to make, kind of when you're outputting variables, checking your code, how it's running, to give you an idea of what those numbers are, where those numbers are coming from. Right? So in this case, maybe you have motor speed, and that's the variable you're printing out or something. Okay? You do a similar thing with floats, right? But instead of colon D, it's colon F. You can also print out 2 a specified number of significant digits on your floats. Right? So I can do 0.4F, and I'm going to get 4 decimal places for any float that I try to print with that particular thing. I can do 0.2F, 0.9F, whatever. Okay. We can also print pad out in front of the floats as well. Right? So 9 is the total length. And what it's saying, of those 9 total spaces I'm going to print out, I want to have at least 2 of them have a 2 decimal places at the end. So it's 2 decimal places, a period, and then I have 6 numbers out front, 6 spaces out front to fill with numbers. Okay. Similar things. Okay. A few special characters in those prints that can also make your print output easier to read, which again is really important for debugging. Right? Slash n will create a new line. It's like hitting an enter in the middle of your string. So it'll print out kind of on 2 different lines. There's carriage return, which is kind of the same. And then slash T is tab. So you can tab between pieces in your string. So for example, if we had pi from before, right? So this would print out pi on one line, hit enter here, and this would basically print out on the next line when it comes over your REPL into your computer from the pi board. Or I could do something similar with a tab in between. Questions about those print statements? Use these a lot. Yeah. Carriage return, for your purposes, it's just like a new line. They're basically the same here for MicroPython. If you're writing for a kind of full computer, if you will, Windows will handle an R differently than it handles an N. There's a different standard in which one, the order they should come. Unix-based machines want both. So they want a new line and a carriage return. So carriage return, I think of a typewriter going back to the beginning of the line. Right, so not just a new line, return the carriage back over to the left side. So it's kind of left over from that kind of terminology. So depending on what kind of system you're working on, if you're writing on a full computer, the order of those or which one you need to use will be different. On the Pi board, both of those will just create a new line for you. Tab will do 4 spaces. Yeah. Other questions? Use these a lot, right? So you have some logic running and it's not working. Don't just guess at what's happening. Start inserting a print statements all through that, right? Print inside function 1, right? And that will print out, and every time that function gets called, it will print out inside function 1 to your REPL. Right? You can print out intermediate variable values of variables, right, to help you know, before sensor check, after sensor check, variable equal, variable, you know, those kind of things. Right? We'll be doing that quite a lot. Let's talk kind of the last piece of today about Python control structures. All right, so we talked about functions. We haven't really said about kind of conditional execution, right, which is at the core of kind of how you write code. Effectively, we want if some stuff happens, then do this, and variations on that, right? If I get some kind of sensor reading, then turn my motor at a certain, some kind of speed, right? So we have a lot number of ways to control program flow, conditionally execute. We're going to talk about if then kind of loops. We're going to have for loops, and we're going to talk about while loops. Okay, and pretty much any language has these same structures. All that really changes is the syntax around how they operate. Right. So you start learning the Python stuff and understand how what a if-then loop structure is itself. All that it would take when you get to MATLAB or you want to learn C++ or something is to figure out, well, okay, what's the different little bit different in syntax? Structures are the same. Okay. In order to conditionally execute code, you need some kind of comparison cases to evaluate. Right? Our if-then needs some kind of condition to be true or false before the then part happens, right? So in Python, these look like this, okay? So to compare X and Y, you use two equal signs, right? So two equal signs says, is X equal to Y? Okay? And if X is equal to Y, this will return true. A Python Boolean true. If X is not equal to Y, it gives you back false. Okay. Make sure you use two equal signs there if you're trying to do a comparison. If you only use one, what's going to happen? It's going to set them equal to each other. Right? Use one equal sign, you're saying, well, okay, I want X to be equal to whatever's in Y. Okay. So you need two equal signs. That will still trip you up even after you write Python for 10 years. Which, actually, never mind. It'll still trip you up if you have been writing Python for 4 years, which is how long I've been doing Python. Not equal is exclamation point equal. So this is true if X and Y are different, and false otherwise. So if X and Y are equal, that one is false. Right? So that's a not equal sign. Right? The greater than and less than work pretty much like you'd expect. So these are the conditionals we have to work with in Python. In pretty much every language, you're going to have these. Okay, so let's look at an if-then structure. Right? The syntax will look something like this. We'll look at some specific examples in just a second. Okay, basically, it's if, and you can generally we'll have some parentheses there to group the terms together. If condition 1 is true, then everything indented underneath that if block is then run. Okay? So I'd have some code here indented underneath that. Right? If that condition is not true, then it comes back over and keeps going. It doesn't run any of the code that's indented. Okay? I can have an else if, the syntax is elif, has to be exactly this. So if condition 1 is true, I'll run the stuff in the first loop and then actually bounce out and be done with the whole if thing, if structure. Okay? If it's not true, then I would come down. Else, if condition 2 is true, I'll run what's indented underneath condition 2's, that else, elif. Okay? I can have as many of those elifs as I want, checking different conditions and doing different things. Okay, I can also end with just a plain else. Okay, so in this case, if neither condition 1 or condition 2 are true, I'm going to run this piece, whatever's indented underneath the else. Okay, everybody following that structure? Okay. The key here, like the function, is that the indentation is what tells Python, what tells the board, what should be run as part of this elif, or what should be run part of that elif. Yeah?
So if X equals Y, and if that's true, then it will... Oh, no, sorry.
Okay. We got an example that will maybe clear it up. Okay? First example. Okay? So here's kind of a setup. We haven't really said what counter is, right? So our LF here is gets down to this line, so it's running line by line, right? Gets down to if counter less than 10, checks that condition. If that's true, then it runs whatever code I have indented under here. Okay. If that was true and I ran this code, then I bounce all the way outside here and keep going. Okay, ignores the rest of that if block. Okay. If that was false, then I come down to the next line of that if then block, and it's an elif, it checks, hey, is counter greater than or equal to 20? If that's true, it runs what's indented here underneath that elif. When it finishes that, it bounces all the way out to the end and keeps going. Okay? If counter is not less than 10 or greater than or equal to 20, neither of those things are true. It comes down to else, runs what's indented here, finishes that, and then keeps going after that. Okay. So again, the key, indentation. You do need the colons at the end here. Just like we did for the functions, those colons matter in this case. Okay? Okay, let's look at an example. And you guys tell me what's going to happen. What are we going to have? What's going to happen? Short. Right. A is equal to 2. So the first check, right, to figure that out, right, go line by line. Don't assume anything, right? So the first line is A greater than 5. Well, no. Right? So goes, knows that's not true, comes down to the next condition. Comes down to the elif. A is equal to 2. Well, that is true, so I run what's indented underneath that guy. Exactly right. And then once it prints that, it exits. Once it finishes that indented block, it exits the whole if elif structure. Yes?
If do both wrong and print hello.
Print hello, that's right. So it keeps going down that stack until it finds something that's true or gets to an else. Should also point out that you don't need an elif or an else. Right? All that's really required is the if. So if you don't have these secondary conditions for whatever you're trying to do, you can just leave them off. You can just have an if by itself.
Okay. So if could be right and then print if.
Well, so you could have if A greater than 5, print raindrops, and then code after that. And it would get to that, and while A is not greater than 5, it just would continue going. So it checks it, would do whatever is indented, and if it wasn't true, it just comes back out to the main code and keeps going. So there could be a condition where you don't have any kind of secondary conditions to check. You just want to, if it's not true, keep going. Yes?
Can you have a bunch of else?
Yes. So you can have as many elifs as you need for your logic. All right, so you could have 15 of these down if you want. Yeah.
How fast is this checking? Like, I know it's like, it's going to happen all at once, but as far as going through each, if...
I think you're, yeah, so the processor on your board, 75 megahertz, I think. So this happens effectively instantly.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if there was like an actual slow time frame.
No. Okay. Not unless you're slowing it yourself.
Okay.
Yes.
So if an elif are both false, it would print hello?
Yes. All right. So you can have 15 different elifs. You don't need an elif or an else, or you could have just an if and an else. Right? So these, you have to have the if you want to use if, of course. Right? You can't have an elif by itself. Right? But if you have an if, you could have just an else. You could have a bunch of elifs and no else if you wanted. Right? So the other pieces are kind of optional. You can have only one pure else, though. You can have one if at a certain level, one else, bunch of elifs. Okay? You also can do things like this. Right? So you can do some simple computation inside. Right? So what does this one do? Yeah, so there's the question. We get all the way down to hello. Right? Neither condition, neither one of the first two conditions is true. We get down and print hello. Okay. I would caution against, something like this is fine. I would caution against having really complex computations in that conditional because they get hard to read. It's going to be hard to debug what's happening there. So you want to store them in a secondary variable. Okay. Questions about if loops, if then structures, blocks. Okay, how about basic for loops? For loop syntax looks like this. It's pretty simple. It's for, in this case, counter is some variable name. Right? You get to call that whatever you want. Could be index, could be motor, whatever you want to call it. So for something in some kind of sequence. So you have that variable, right? And every time this for loop runs, that variable gets incremented one time up. Yes?
If you wanted, like, okay, you want the program to do a certain thing, so why would you have wrong ifs and elifs?
So for example, I want my motors to run while I'm not at the center of the track, right? And I have some sensor that's measuring the distance, which you're going to have, right? So if that sensor is measuring something greater than being close to the middle of the track, if that's true, keep running the motors, else stop. So the for loop, you have a counter, and then you have some sequence. Right? And there's a few options. Right? The one that you probably will use most in here is something like this. You're going to use a special keyword range. So range and a number will give you 10 numbers, right? Starting with 0. Right? So range 10 gives you 0 to 9. Okay? So for counter and range 10, this for loop will run 10 times, right? Because this range has 10 values to loop through. Okay. This is a pretty common one for this class, right? So counter, right? The first, the Python code would get down to this guy, this for loop. It's going to say, well, okay, first time through this loop, counter is going to be 0. Gets down to the end of the indentation. Let's back up. Okay, there's still values left in range. Right? So give the next one to counter. So 1, go through. Is back up. Is there still data left in range? Okay, 2 is left. So I store that in counter and run. It keeps looping that way. Yes?
So in this example, counter isn't defined initially, like in for loops?
Doesn't need to be.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes?
Is there a way to like set the time as to how fast?
Yeah, so we'll see that on Tuesday for sure. So there's timing stuff built into the pipe, kind of PyBoard specific things. So far, everything we've discussed applies to general Python as well. So PyBoard specifically has some delays, and the kind of desktop type Python has a separate timing library that's different. So another way you can do for loops is to have a list of something, right? And it's going to give you the element one at a time. So I could have a list of pies, right? And this for loop, the first time through, it's going to say, well, how does list of pies have anything left to give me? Right? So the first time through it, yeah, that's true. It's going to, first element it has to give me is apple. That gets stored in pie, which then gets printed out. Right? For loop gets to its end. It goes back to the top. Does the list of pies have anything left to give me? Well, yeah, it has cherry and pumpkin. So it takes the next one, cherry, save that in the pie, which then gets run in the code. So it loops through like that. So this particular piece of code would print this stuff out. Right? So it just loops through those two lines loop through and print these three statements. Okay. You can also keep the index, which gets a little bit fancier, but allows you to kind of number each one of those as well. Right. So we'll, some of our motor control, this is a convenient way to do that, actually. Okay. Questions about for loops? Talk about while loops. While loops have a condition at the beginning, right? And if that condition is true, then everything indented underneath that while loop will run. Okay, it's run down, right? Code not indented block is finishing. So code runs, you get down to the bottom. It goes back up to the beginning of the while loop, checks the condition again. Is that condition still true? If it is, run the code in the loop again. So we'd run again, loop back up to the top. Is the condition still true? Right? That's where it gets the name. Basically, keep doing this as while the condition is true. If it's not true, then stop. Okay? So let's take a look at an example. Kind of key point here is that condition is tested at the beginning of each time through that piece of code. So, for example, we might have an index variable called index equal to 0, and then this kind of simple while loop. Right? So we get down to the while loop, and it checks, is index less than 10? Is it? Yes. Right. So that's true. That would return a true. So then that tells this while loop, okay, that means I want you to run what's inside here, what's indented underneath the loop. Which in this case is going to print out index equals what?
Zero.
Zero, first time through. What happens in the next line? We add 2 to index. So now what is index? Index is 2. We get back. So that's all the code that's inside that while loop. We jump back up to check the condition again. So is index, which is 2, less than 10? It's true. So we run what's indented underneath the while loop again. Add 2 more, keep going that way. Right? So this basically just prints out even numbers less than 10. Okay. What does this guy do? Kind of a combination, we have a while loop and an if. Okay? Maybe. Okay. It's only going to print 3, right? So let's walk through why that's the case, right? You're trying to figure out how a piece of code works or why your code's not working. It's kind of the same set of skills. Just walk through line by line. Don't make any assumptions about what's happening. Just do what's there explicitly, right? Remember, the computer's going to do only what you tell it, nothing more, nothing less. It's going to do exactly what you tell it, right? So index is 0. Is the while condition true the first time through? Yes. Okay. So it says, okay, I'm going to run what's indented underneath me, right? Okay. Well, then the first thing indented under there is an if, right? Is the conditional of the if statement true? Right. 0 is not equal to 3. So that will return false. So we don't do the code that's indented under him, right? We come down and add 1 to index. Right. Well, that's the last piece of code in our while loop, so we go back up again to the beginning of the while. Okay. Is 1 less than 10? Yes. Okay. Is 1 equal to 3? No. So we don't print, come down, add 1 more to it, loop back over. We get 2. 2 less than 10. That's true, so we run the code inside. 2 equal to 3? No. So we skip that piece. Add 1. Is 3 less than 10? Yes. So, okay, we're going to run the code that's in the while loop. And we have the if is 3 equal to 3. Yes. So, okay, that's true now, so we run what's indented under the if. Which means we're going to print that out. Okay. Once that's done, we bounce back out, bounce back one indentation level. add one to index, and keep going. Right? Is index ever equal to 3 again? No, not here. So that just prints index as 3. Okay. One way that this can come up, and I think quite a nice way to use while loops in your code, is to have these kind of flag variables. Right? So you might have some variable called keep running. Right? It may be tied to our example earlier. I want to keep running the motors until I touch the center of the thing. Right? So in my code, I always have kind of keep running happening. Right? And I'm doing stuff if keep running is true. In this case, I set it to false when the index gets greater than or equal to 10. So maybe 10 revolutions in the motors, or 10 seconds, or 10 times through this loop to run the motor. And then once I can set, I change the value of keep running inside the while loop, actually. It will still finish that iteration, go back up, check true or false, and bounce outside. So this is kind of a nice way to handle these while loops, to run until I tell you not to run anymore, basically. So you can explicitly change the conditional to be true or false. And you notice here we have, because keep running is a Boolean, I can put it directly as the conditional. I don't have to say while keep running equal to true, right? The evaluation always is a Boolean already. Although you can. You're welcome to do that. So that's kind of what happens in that piece of code. Questions about while loops? Okay. So then, for Tuesday, make sure to install that driver if necessary on Windows. If you follow those instructions and you get to your device manager and you don't see like exclamation warning thing is not there, you're probably good to go. Okay. If you haven't already, install Atom. Or if you have a favorite text editor, feel free to use that. Okay. Install one of those serial programs. Right. Again, I'm going to support and show you guys cool term. If you have strong feelings about one of the other ones, feel free to use another one. Right. But we're going to help and we're going to show cool term. Okay. Review these notes. Hold on a second, guys. I'm not done yet. Okay. Review these notes. Right? You went through probably a good chunk of you have not really done any programming before. So it's all brand new. Right? You're not going to get it just sitting here. I can't just hand it to you. So go back, spend some time with it. Okay? The MicroPython getting starting guide is also pretty well done. Right? So, and it assumes you're starting from more or less zero too. So I strongly recommend you're going to be way ahead of the game. Your job is going to be totally easy on Tuesday if you spend just a little bit of time with these notes before then and a little bit of time looking through the MicroPython Getting Started guide. Okay. And then if you have a laptop you want to bring along with your kit on Tuesday, feel free. If you don't have a laptop, that's cool too. You can just look over the shoulder of your neighbor and help them out. Okay. Questions about any of that? Yes. Yeah, I have a meeting 6 to 6:30-ish, but other than that, I'll be around. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, thank you.